there's our music to let us know that we are on the air, and that's what you're listening to, On the Air with Glenn Coble. And today we have Fred Malone from the Marion Historical Society, and we're going over all sorts of interesting stuff. We're going to do a little flip here, and we're going to go over, so he's found a remarkable book that tells him everything you'd want to know and some things you don't care to know about the White House and the presidents. So how you doing, Fred? We're going to give them some information they had never heard.
Absolutely.
All right.
The thing with the information is it's little known information.
Yeah.
Not things that you would ordinarily know about, even if you were a student of history, because I've been a student of history since
I know you have. Yeah.
Junior high school, minored in history at Ohio University.
Yes, of course, Buckeyes.
These are just things that I think are very interesting to people. As I told Glenn earlier, today we're going to concentrate. We're going to start with some interesting things about Lincoln's administration.
Excellent.
And finish up with talking a little bit about when Grant was in the White House, and then talking about a couple of things from the White House. But I did want to mention that with Abraham Lincoln, anybody that has read much about Abraham Lincoln knows for a fact that when he set up his cabinet, his presidential cabinet, that he selected a lot of people who were not necessarily his friends.
Yeah, I did know that.
But were his enemies, basically.
People that tell him no.
And the old adage of keep your friends close and your enemies closer was one thing that Lincoln kind of lived with in his cabinets. And I think it worked out extremely well for him. And one of the ones that was probably one of his biggest enemies at the onset was Edwin Stanton. And of course, he was Lincoln's Secretary of War. Now, this is very important because basically from the time Lincoln took the presidency until he was assassinated in 1865, the war raged on practically the entire time. In fact, ended just a few days before his demise. So I want to start off today talking about Lincoln and Stanton and that relationship. And this information is coming from a book called Best Little Stories from the White House. Over a period of years, a guy by the name of Brian Kelly, along with the help from a lady by the name of Ingrid Smyer, put this information together. And it basically goes from George Washington all the way up to Barack Obama.
Huh.
So it's a fascinating book. So it's not too old. But the information that's in here, we've been using this over the last several months, talking about presidents and their pets, presidents and their wives, presidents who stayed in the White House or had relatives in the White House, and people that died in the White House and all those kind of things. So if you've been listening to us, that's where most of this information is coming from. And as I told Glenn, unfortunately, I don't remember as well as I used to, so I can't pull a lot of this information from my memory. So a lot of what I'm giving you today is coming directly from the book. And again, I apologize because I just don't remember things as well as I used to.
Well, you don't have to apologize to me, as you know.
And again, from the fellow that just called in, the older man that just called in, I certainly hope that he is able to get a ticket and share some time with us at the presidential dinner.
Yes.
Because anybody that is interested in history will thoroughly enjoy that dinner.
Absolutely.
And you'll learn some interesting facts from the presenters. If you're lucky enough to get a seat at a table with one of the presidential presenters, you'll learn a lot of other interesting information with table talk, which is what I think is great.
Yeah.
And then, of course, with the food being taken from the White House recipes, that's just a big bonus, a big plus.
Absolutely.
All right. Abe Lincoln and his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, did not start out as close friends. The outspoken Stanton once said he found no token of any intelligent understanding by Lincoln.
Oh, my. He didn't like him at all.
Or the crew that governed him. As time went on, however, Lincoln worked more closely with Stanton than with any other of his cabinet members because of what we just talked about before. And Stanton's esteem for this president steadily improved over the months and the years that enveloped. If there were any doubt as to their eventual closeness, a seat at the White House after the Battle of Gettysburg would serve to dispel any of those rumors. For here, late that night of July the 3rd, 1863, the last day of the three-day battle, came a breathless Stanton pounding up the White House stairs, dispatch in hand, and then knocking on Lincoln's bedroom door.
Hmm.
Now, if you can set this scene, it's you know, midnight or later.
Yeah.
Here's Stanton running to the White House. And, of course, at that time, the war room was right next door to the White House.
Oh.
So that's where all the telegraph messages would come in. And Lincoln actually spent a lot of time in the telegraph room. He would walk from the White House over to the telegraph room, which was in what would now be part of the West Wing,
mm-hmm.
But then would have been a separate building. "Who's there?" asked Lincoln, half asleep, and the simple reply was all Lincoln needed to know. "Stanton," was the reply. Lincoln, with a light in hand, opened the door. He appeared, said the account in the New York Tribune of January the 23rd, 1887, in his nightclothes. In the shortest nightgown and the longest legs, recalled Stanton later, that he had ever witnessed on a human being. Now, I can just set the scene. Here's Lincoln, like 6'8", 6'9",
yeah.
with this little shorty nightgown on. And Lincoln knew just what Stanton wished to impart. Once his war secretary caught his breath, he knew that Gettysburg had to win a victory. Such a crucial victory, because Lincoln gave out a shout of exultation, grabbed him with both arms around the waist, and danced him around the chamber until they both were exhausted.
Now, what a great picture, yeah.
Picture the scene. It's just fantastic. The pair then sat down on a nearby trunk. Lincoln, still in his sleepwear, read the War Department telegram again and again, and they stayed there until dawn as they talked over the probabilities of the future and the results of that victory.
Wow.
In the future, of course, was Lincoln's assassination 2 years later, a prospect that Stanton had feared and guarded against for some time. It was the war secretary who even ruthlessly pressed the prosecution of anyone involved in that assassination conspiracy, including the woman that was involved in the assassination.
And she was hung, was she not?
She was the mother of one of the... Yes, she was. The first woman to be hung. Right. Stanton may not have said of Lincoln's death, "Now he belongs to the ages." That's always been kind of a quote that was attributed to him, but they can't prove it, as is often referred to, but he certainly mourned his friend and his colleague. Lincoln's son, Robert Todd, said, "For more than 10 days after my father's death in Washington, Stanton called on me in my room and spent the first few minutes of his visits weeping uncontrollably without saying a word."
Hmm.
So, I mean, it affected him tremendously, the fact that Lincoln was assassinated.
Adversaries
have grown to be very close friends over that four year and some odd months' time.
Adversaries sometimes become the strongest friends.
True, and that is also true of several of the other cabinet members that Lincoln assembled to be his cabinet when he started out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'll find that subsequent presidents over the year have oftentimes picked members of their cabinet. Not all, mm-hmm. but some have picked a few members of their cabinet that were adversaries before and members of opposite parties to become members of the cabinet, because you don't always necessarily want someone around you that's going to automatically say yes to everything you say.
That's right.
That's where real problems begin and failures occur.
Yeah. And it's easier to tell somebody you absolutely disagree with and you don't even like. It's easier to tell them the truth sometimes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think, and again, and with Stan particularly, they were truly adversaries. In fact, there was some talk of Stanton even being a presidential candidate running against Lincoln in Lincoln's first term. So, I mean, he definitely was someone that was on Lincoln's radar, because he was definitely an adversary and could possibly be a contender for president,
mm-hmm.
and was popular enough and, again, was from Ohio.
Oh, really?
Was from Ohio. Huh. So, you know, Ohio was very prominent in presidential politics.
And they have been throughout the years.
Yes. Yeah. And, I mean, birthplace of presidents, eight, if you count the one we share with Virginia. So, you know, a lot of things could have happened if Stanton had been a candidate for president then.
Yeah. Interesting.
The next story I want to talk about is a gentleman by the name of Ward Hill Lamon. he was, well, as the story will unfold, he was a an attorney, and also worked in the same law office that Lincoln worked in with Herndon in Springfield back before Lincoln became president. And in the early years, when Lincoln was still a functioning attorney, a practicing attorney, and also had served in the Illinois legislature. And also, you know, Lincoln, a lot of people don't know Lincoln served one term in the U.S. Congress, too. Unfortunately, he wasn't reelected, but he did spend 2 years. And he did fight in the Black Hawk War.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so he was a veteran as well.
He would have been an easy target. He was so tall.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. So this particular segment is called Persistent Bodyguard, 1860s. On election night of 1864, when things had been running hot and close for Abraham Lincoln in his bid for a second presidential term, a burly Virginia-born lawyer set himself upside Lincoln's White House door with pistols and knives. Born in the Old Dominion, but later an attorney on the 8th Judicial Circuit in Illinois with Lincoln, Ward Hill Lamont was a devoted disciple. It certainly did appear that, anyway. More or less appointing himself as a bodyguard, he had accompanied the president-elect in his secret dash by nighttime train through the rebel-infested Baltimore for the first Lincoln inauguration in Washington. Now, as I remember, I think I've told this story before, there was a plot discovered by Pinkerton that the rebels had planned to assassinate Lincoln before he ever got to Washington to be inaugurated the first time around. And so Ward Hill Lamont, again, stepped to the forefront and said, "I'm going to be your bodyguard, whether you want it or not." The new president rewarded his old friend and circuit-riding colleague by appointing him Marshal of the District of Columbia, so he did hold an official position. The post, much like that of an old-time sheriff, was suitable enough for the man who had accompanied Lincoln on the train with protection gear that included brass knuckles, pistols, a knife, and a gun. Now, Hill, as he was called, could preside at special ceremonies and even run the local prison in Washington, D.C. because of his fact that he was marshal for the District of Columbia. He found Virginia troops to follow his banner in the Civil War, as Union men, of course. Later, when Lincoln so famously spoke at Gettysburg, Lamont was marshal-in-chief for the ceremonial parade into the cemetery that was being dedicated. He later introduced a speaker, his old colleague, Lincoln. So he was the one that did the introduction for Lincoln.
For the Gettysburg Address. And it was a very short one.
It was.
As opposed to his predecessor, who took like 2 hours, guy that spoke before him.
It was a poet, Edward Everett Horton.
It took forever.
Still times were rough and worried over Lincoln's safety. The president at least once had been shot at in public. A hole apparently was shot in his hat one day when he journeyed the 4 miles from the real White House downtown to his summer White House at the Soldiers' Home, which is where he spent most of the summers because it was on the bay and cooler.
Yeah, sure.
Lamont kept warning Lincoln of possible betrayers right in the White House, suggesting a screening system for anyone asking to see the president. Now, it's important to note that back during the early presidencies, and clear up until the time that Franklin Roosevelt assumed office and World War II broke out, that the White House was not an enclosed fortress.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could still walk up to the front door, knock on the door, and ask to see the president, and oftentimes would be invited in and asked to take a seat in one of the hallways, and if he had time, you could get in, and if he didn't, you didn't.
No, it wasn't that way. When I was a senior in high school, we went to the White House.
Absolutely.
And even then, it was very little security.
Well, after Pearl Harbor, of course, in 1941, that's when the White House basically closed down.
Yeah.
And where you had to
go through gates,
and you had to have special reason to be there and credentials and so forth. But up until this time, it was the people's house, truly the people's house, and you could enter whenever you wanted to. Lamont actually at once proposed the arrest of a seditious-sounding congressman, and during the heated campaign of 1864, began himself spending the night at the White House to keep Lincoln safe.
We need him now.
We do. He warned Lincoln repeatedly to be more careful in public, and even after the election, he was terribly upset to hear that Lincoln had gone to the theater one night with a foreign diplomat and Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts and no one else. Neither of Lincoln's companions on that particular night could defend themselves against an assault from any able-bodied woman in the city, according to Lamont. He begged Lincoln's secretary and aide John Nicolay to make sure that Lincoln never left the White House alone, either in the day or the nighttime. Lincoln had a habit of leaving the White House anytime he wanted, climbing on a horse and riding off, and no one knew where he was.
Well, he was a pretty able-bodied pugilist himself.
He could take care of himself. He was known for his boxing ability and for his ability to take care of himself. But, however, there were a lot of armed people running around in Washington, D.C. during the Civil War. One night in April of 1865, of course, Lincoln attended the theater again, Ford's Theater, which was his favorite place to go. He wasn't alone. He was under guard, but he was shot and fatally wounded anyway, which we all know. One has to wonder...
He was with his wife, and he was with
a young major from the Civil War and a lady that was accompanying the major. And he did have a police officer from the Washington, D.C. police who was supposed to be on guard outside the door to his little room where his seats were.
What happened to him?
Call those rooms, but So one has to wonder what might have been the result if Lincoln himself had not sent Lamon to Richmond, and he sent Lamon to Richmond, to the fallen capital of the Confederacy, just 3 days before that, to report on the condition of Virginia and prospects for reconstruction. Yeah. Now, Lamon came hurrying back to become marshal of the state general for his old friend. But here's what happened. This officer from the Washington, D.C. police was assigned to be outside the door of Lincoln's little cubbyhole where he and his wife and this major and his lady friend were watching the play Our Cousin, Our First Cousin, or Something Cousin. And sometime during the evening, and Booth had already scoped all this out. He had pre-planned this along with several other individuals. They had planned to kidnap Lincoln and to hold him for ransom. And basically the ransom was to end the war and concede to the Confederacy. So they didn't start out to assassinate him. They started out to kidnap him. But sometime during the evening, during the play, this patrolman or individual from the Washington, D.C. police decided that he would go across the street to the local tavern and have a couple of beers. And that was just the time that Booth needed. When he left, that's when he made his advance. And on the spur of the moment, Booth decided to assassinate rather than to capture and take the president. So had Lamont been there, had Ward Hill Lamont been there, had things been different? Maybe, maybe not. We really don't know. But that's a story that most people don't know.
Yeah.
And again, the fact that he did send him, that Lincoln actually did send him away, you wonder if that's kismet or actually what happened. One has to wonder also why Lamon, 7 years later, this is interesting, lent his name to a biography of Lincoln that was perceived at the time as being overly critical and vulgar. Lincoln's parents never married, it seemed to hint, and Lincoln himself wasn't really so pious and liked dirty jokes.
Why not?
The book apparently was written by a gentleman by the name of Chauncey Black, son of a Lamon law partner, and was largely based on Lamon's recollections and notes from one-time Lincoln law partner William Herndon. Now, William Herndon and Lincoln were very good friends. In fact, the last thing he said to Herndon when he left Springfield to go to Washington was, "I'll be back to resume our law practice together." One has to really think about had he called Lamon his particular friend. Why would Lamon make such statements to somebody writing a book that was derogatory to Lincoln so many years later? So
yeah,
I don't know. It's speculation. It's food for thought. But I thought it was an interesting story that most people don't realize.
Yeah.
The fact that had Ward Lamont Hill been standing outside that door that night, had history not taken place as it did with, unfortunately, that gentleman who left his post and went and had a couple of beers.
Yeah, that's pretty sad. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. And somebody just told me within the last, well, I think it was last week, that they went to a Chautauqua over in Ashland that was all about Mary Surratt. Mary Surratt was the lady that was hanged and was tried as part of the conspiracy. She was the mother of Charles Surratt, who was one of the instigators, one of the partners with Booth that had set up this whole thing. And I don't remember whether it was Surratt that was to kill. I think he was the one that was assigned to kill Andrew Johnson, then vice president, and backed out at the last minute because Johnson was staying at one of the hotels near the White House, and he was supposed to go kill him and backed out at the last minute, and so that never took place. So the whole story is very interesting.
Yeah, it is.
A lot is not known about Mary Lincoln, and a lot is known. It depends on how deeply you want to delve yourselves into Mary Lincoln. But I found this information here that I thought was very interesting about Mary Lincoln, and I thought we would share this with
Sure. A lot of the stuff that we know about her is just hearsay stuff. It's kind of mean.
It is. Well, yeah. a lot of it is. And, of course, she did have some seriously bad
Yes.
habits, which Lincoln dealt with on a regular basis. But she basically was a really depressed woman
Yeah.
for the most of her life. And I really think she had, well, they're finding out today, I think she had mental issues.
Well, she lost, what, two sons?
Right. Yeah. And we're going to go through that in this particular segment.
All right.
Already a deeply disturbed woman, Mary Todd Lincoln was so devastated by her husband's assassination that she would not attend his funeral.
Really?
Not even leave the executive mansion for 6 weeks. She stayed there 6 weeks. By then, the funeral, actually a series of dramatic events, was over. 16 days in the unfolding. She had had a voice in some of its planning, though. It was her decision, for instance, that he should be buried in their last hometown of Springfield, Illinois, because originally the powers that be wanted him to be buried in Arlington.
Mm-hmm.
But she insisted that he be buried in Springfield. And it was by her wish that little Willie Lincoln's coffin would be disinterred from Oak Hill Cemetery in Georgetown, and that little Willie would accompany his father on the long train trip back to Springfield and lie there beside him in that cemetery. And in fact, we'll talk about that a little bit, when the train rolled through very many towns throughout the Midwest, the same route actually that Lincoln took on his inauguration run,
which was kind of secret
was
trip.
Was the same route that the train took back. Willie's coffin was in the same train car and was visible to people that saw the coffin, also saw Willie's.
And I've seen pictures of people standing next to the railroad, just sobbing.
Thousands. The very afternoon of his last day, Lincoln cited the recent end of the rending Civil War and suggested that between that terrible burden and the loss of our darling Willie, he and his wife had both been very miserable. True, after Willie's death from a typhoid-like fever on February the 20th of 1862, Mary Todd had been so distraught that she never again would enter the rooms in which he died and where he was embalmed. Now, her husband's body also had been embalmed on the premises in the Prince of Wales room on the second floor in the West Hall, the very room where Willie had died. First, 9 doctors had gathered in there for the official autopsy. The spent bullet that killed Lincoln was recovered, dropping from one doctor's hands into a china basin with a clatter. Then came the embalming process. Lincoln's Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, personally dressed the body for public viewing.
Huh.
before the burial. He rejected an offer to mask a bruise showing on Lincoln's face. "No," he said, "this is part of the history of the event." And as we remember, the bullet entered the back of Lincoln's head and never came out the front.
Mm-hmm.
They moved the body the next night down to the East Room. The bearers of the casket shuffled along in their socks to avoid upsetting Mrs. Lincoln with the sound of their shoes while carrying out that unhappy task.
Oh, jeez.
Earlier, she had heard the hammering on the elaborate catafalque being built to hold the casket and thought she was hearing gunshots.
Oh.
It was Tuesday, April the 18th, 1865, that Lincoln, clad in the suit worn at his second inauguration, went on view to the silent public filing through the East Room in two lines. He had been shot the night of April the 14th and had died at 7:22 the next morning in a boarding house across the street from Ford's Theater. At noon on April the 19th came the first funeral service. The Reverend Phineas D. Gurley officiated, and Lincoln's son Robert Todd was in attendance, but not Mrs. Lincoln. That afternoon, the Lincoln coffin was taken to the Capitol, where it remained on view through the next day, which was a Thursday. On Friday morning began the train trip home to Springfield, Illinois, arranged by Stanton to nearly duplicate the route that Lincoln had taken on his way to Washington from Springfield back in 1861 when he became president. So it was that this train made its major stops at Baltimore, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, New York City, Garrison's Landing near West Point, Albany, Buffalo, Cleveland, Columbus, Ohio, Indianapolis, Chicago, and finally Springfield. All along the route, small town or large, crowds and dignitaries marked Lincoln's passing among them day or night. And I can picture this in my mind, and I've seen photographs of this. And as I sit here recounting this, I have chills in my
arms. Yeah, I remember seeing those pictures too.
At Richmond, Indiana, just after 3 in the morning, some 12,000 persons turned out, a number exceeding the local population of the town. Funeral arches greeted the train in many towns, and I've seen photographs of these funeral arches, black, with blackened flowers and ribbons, along with tolling bells and saluting guns. Two former presidents saw the funeral train slide by its 5-mile-per-hour pace for viewing, both James Buchanan and Millard Fillmore. In New York, local officials thought to bar Representative Blacks from attending part of the official procession from train to City Hall and back, but Stanton quashed that unwholesome thought and let them attend. At last, on May 4th, Lincoln was buried, at least temporarily, at Oak Ridge Cemetery in Springfield, with the Reverend Wright Matthew Simpson, a Methodist bishop, giving the funeral oration. Lincoln's remains would later be placed in a permanent tomb at the National Lincoln Monument in the same cemetery in 1882, but not before there had been a plot to steal his remains and hold them hostage for the release of a counterfeiter from an Illinois prison in Joliet.
Oh, jeez.
Lincoln buried 20 days after his death. The funeral train, statisticians may wish to know, traveled exactly 1,262 miles and was only 1 hour late arriving in Springfield. A small fact, but for the record.
It's kind of interesting that if I'm picturing in my mind, that route doesn't go anywhere straight.
No, it doesn't. It is a terribly winding route.
The straightest part was Chicago to Springfield.
Yeah, and if you look at a map, and I've read a couple of books that chronicle the route. It actually backtracks in several different locations in order to get into Baltimore from Springfield. So, and I believe it was just last year, down at the Ohio State House, they had on display the flag that draped Lincoln's coffin when it lay in repose in the rotunda of the Ohio State House.
Huh.
And I'm not sure whether it's still down there now or not. But
I didn't realize
it was on the anniversary. Yeah.
So did they allow the casket to be placed in several locations on the route?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I think it, well, I'm not sure if it lay in repose in Cleveland or not, but definitely it was in Columbus. Mm-hmm. And I think there may have been a couple other locations. Now, the casket wasn't open.
No.
It was never open. And to my knowledge, there is only one photograph that has existed that showed the casket open, and you could actually see the face of Lincoln. Now, a couple of months ago, on the national news, supposedly another photograph had surfaced that was bought by somebody at a yard sale, of all places. You hear of all these crazy things of people buying stuff from yard sales. And to my knowledge, it is still in the process of being authenticated, because the first photograph was taken, I believe, when it was in the Capitol building in Washington from above somewhere, and it was taken by an Army officer, I think, and the Army officer actually got in trouble for taking the photograph, or arranging for taking the photograph. So for another photograph to be taken, it had to have been done in secret. And I was really kind of surprised that there was public viewing allowed in the White House. And no place does it say that the casket was open. So I'm not sure whether it was ever opened for the public to see. But I kind of gather in the East Room that it was, because of Stanton's comment to leave the bruise uncovered,
mm-hmm.
so that people could actually see the bruising that was created.
Isn't it kind of an honor that they bestow upon certain politicians to have their casket put on the
same catapult?
Yeah, the catapult.
It is. I know Kennedy's was on the same catapult. Kennedy's was also on the same caisson.
Is that right?
Yes. And to my knowledge, I think
King was on.
Yes, he was. Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm not too sure that Senator McCain wasn't on the same caisson.
I think that's true, too. Yeah.
So it is a high honor. And in fact, I want to say, and I know I think I've read this someplace, I want to say that the saddle that was used on the horse that walked behind the caisson,
backwards saddle,
for Kennedy's, was also the same saddle that was used at Lincoln's.
Oh, that's amazing. So, Goosebumps, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. The whole thing does. So what are we doing for time here?
Oh, we got about 14 minutes.
Okay, so we got some more time.
Sure.
All right. The Dent family. Ulysses Grant married a Dent.
Oh, okay.
Julia was a Dent. So the next thing I want to talk about is a rebel in the house in the 1870s. This is an interesting story, and I don't think it's one that's much known. Unrepentant and unreconstructed was the old Confederate-loving codger who lived in one corner of the White House, who regaled the press with his inside stories, who sat next to the president's wife at dinner, who even then could be scathing in his remarks and unawed by any company, especially that of the president, who in fact was his son-in-law. Old Colonel Frederick Dent was not about to change his spots or dispense with his mint juleps just because he, a Democrat from Missouri, was moving into the White House within a decade of the Civil War with his daughter Julia and her Republican president husband, Ulysses S. Grant. Surely the most Yankee of them all.
Yeah.
He not only was a White House fixture after the Grants moved in, he accompanied them on family vacations and even on an occasional political foray. He could say very embarrassing things regardless of who was present at the presidential dinner table, and one of his favorite victims apparently was the president's own father, Jesse Grant.
Oh, geez.
Dent called him that old gentleman, and oft once complained in the elder Grant's presence, he is feeble and deaf as a post, and yet you permit him to wander all over Washington alone. 10 years younger than the 80-plus rebel, and a bit sharp-tongued himself, the elder Grant heard and replied, I hope I shall not live to become as old and infirm as Grandfather Dent. Obviously, those two didn't get along.
I guess not.
Jesse Grant usually passed up a White House guest room and took a local hotel room instead. Possibly because he didn't want to be around Dent.
I guess.
Saying the presidential home held too many from that old tribe of Dents. Instead, the colonel, or judge, as he was alternately called, had a space all of his own in the office suite on the second floor. It was here, indeed, that he often held forth for visitors from the gossip-hungry world of the press. It was also at the dinner table, even at his beloved daughter's very elbow, that he sometimes espoused his most embarrassing opinions. He was really a very opinionated individual from everything I've read about him.
Well, haven't you found out as you get older, you're able to say
more things?
To say
things in a way with it, yeah. I told my wife when I turned 70, hey, the gloves are off. He did occupy a bedroom close to the north portico, and there he died one night in his own bed. His coffin then rested for a time in the Yankee White House, the final stopping place for the ex-slave owner from Missouri.
Oh, he was a slave owner, too.
He was a slave owner in addition to that, yeah.
Interesting.
So I thought that was an interesting story and was one worth sharing.
Great story.
Julia Dent did not like Mary Todd Lincoln.
Well, a lot of people agree with that.
I think that's too much of a secret. On the night, and I don't know whether a lot of people know this or not, but on the night that they attended Ford's Theater to see Our Favorite Cousin, I think was it, the president had invited, much to Mary Todd's chagrin, Ulysses Grant and his wife Julia to attend the dinner with him. Julia threw a fit and told her husband, I'm not going. I don't want to go. I don't like her, and I don't want to go to a play with her. So they cooked up the excuse that because Grant had not seen his children for such a long time, that he wanted to hurry back to see his children, so they passed on going to the theater that night, and that's how they picked up this major and this major's lady friend to go along with them. But originally it was supposed to be Grant and Mrs. Dent, Mrs. Grant. And that was one of the things that Booth knew, that they were supposed to attend Ford's Theater that night with the Lincolns. So he had actually planned to kidnap both of them, not just Lincoln. So that was part of the plot that was devised and then later uncovered. But Mrs. Grant threw a wrench in the whole works when she declined to be seated with Mary Todd Lincoln.
Huh.
Yeah, so. I
assume there are plans that group of seven, I think it was, drew up for the...
For the plot?
Yeah.
Yeah, it all came out basically at the trial.
Okay.
All this information basically came out
How
at the trial.
In the world were they going to... get both of those guys, I guess, at gunpoint?
Oh, it was everything. There were a lot of accomplices involved in that. Mm-hmm. A lot of the accomplices, of course, were never known and were therefore never tried. It was the seven basic accomplices that were part of the original plot and hatched the plot out at Mary Surratt's boarding house, which was basically across the street and down from Ford's Theater.
Yeah, right. So. Yeah, I remember hearing that.
So.
I've played Ford's Theater.
Yeah, I remember you saying that before.
Not personally. I mean, yes, personally, but not alone. It was with the Army Field Band.
The next thing I want to talk about is, and they in the book they title this President is Secret, 1877, and I think this is kind of an interesting story, and it's from, and it's basically about an Ohio president.
Okay, we got 7 minutes.
Okay, this will probably do it.
Okay.
We're not going to get to Archie Butt, but
okay.
I have to keep that for the next time.
All right.
Another time, another day, a gentleman from Ohio was sworn in as President of the United States in the White House itself, in secret. in secret. No counterfeit, nor any political neophyte. He was the well-bearded Rutherford B. Hayes, Civil War hero, former congressman, former governor of Ohio, and now the 19th president of the United States. The history books will say that he was inaugurated on Monday, March the 5th of 1877. And true, he was. But, in secret, he was also sworn in as president Sunday evening, March the 4th, in the Red Room of the White House. It happened during a resplendent dinner party for 38 of Washington's most distinguished celebrities, people such as cabinet members and Supreme Court justices. The hosts were the outgoing president and his wife, Ulysses S. and Julia Grant. The dinner, while a cover of sorts, was real enough, lavish enough, 20 courses served,
oh my,
along with enough variety of drink to fill the 6 different wine glasses at each plate.
There were some tipsy people.
Incoming President Hayes and his wife Lucy were there, and I remember she was called Lemonade Lucy because she didn't allow white alcohol in the White House when they took over. Were there too, but he was still incoming, or now president. Just 2 days before, he didn't really know if he would be president at all.
Is that right? You got to go on with this.
The explanation is a combination of circumstances. First, the hotly fought election of 1876. Excuse me.
No problem.
The centennial year for America. That election had been so close that Republican Hayes trailed his Democratic opponent, Samuel Tilden, in the popular vote, but might have the edge in the all-important electoral vote. Yet here was fresh doubt, not only because of the close popular vote, but also because of charges of chicanery arising in 4 southern states. Sound familiar?
It does sound familiar.
An electoral commission investigating both the vote count and the charges of fraud gave its nod to Hayes only at the last possible minute on March the 2nd. Now enter the calendar. Grant's term would expire Sunday, March the 4th. By tradition, the presidential inauguration was never held on a Sunday. And, of course, in this case, it must await the next day, Monday, March the 5th. Technically, the country would not have a president in office for 24 hours, from noon Sunday to noon Monday, although it had happened twice before in the nation's early history. James Monroe and Zachary Taylor simply skipped the first day of their respective terms by waiting a day for their inauguration. Such a hiatus would not now be desirable.
No, probably not legal.
No. With all the bitterness endangered by the last-minute decision endorsing Hayes, with street demonstrations, cropping up in Washington, sound familiar?
Very familiar.
Grant felt it would be safer for Hayes to take office officially, if not publicly, on Sunday.
Huh.
At dinner that night, the guests began their promenade from the East Room, where they had been received, to the state dining room for the meal itself. Few noticed that Grant and Hayes had taken another route to another room, the Red Room. There, flanked by bearers of flowers, Chief Justice Morin R. Waite administered the oath of office to Rutherford B. Hayes. If all else was carefully prepared for the occasion, one traditionally item was missing. No one had thought to bring a Bible.
Uh-oh.
With no Bible immediately available, the swearing-in proceeded anyway to be followed the next day by a full-blown inauguration, oath-taking on the Bible and all at the Capitol. The president for a day was still president. By the logic dictating that hurried the secret oath taking that evening, however, the nation really did go without a president for a while.
But nobody knew it.
Not a full 24 hours, but for the hours between noon Sunday and the minute of the swearing in that took place in the Red Room on the evening of Sunday, March the 4th.
Amazing.
Without a president.
Absolutely amazing. Well, we got about a minute and a half left to go.
Well,
so
we're going to have to save the story of Archie Butt.
Or Butte. No, Butt. He doesn't have an E at the end of his name.
But it's a great story. And,
okay.
I will mention that he was a great favorite of Teddy Roosevelt, served in the administration of William Howard Taft, and went down on the Titanic.
Oh, my. I didn't know that. That's kind of interesting.
Glenn, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for coming in, and we will keep on talking about the First Lady's Luncheon, even though I think today is the last day they can...
Today, and they'll have to call the office to try to arrange for tickets.
Okay. All right. And you don't have very many left anyway, so hurry up if you're interested. You can call their office. I'll give the phone number real quick, 740-387-4255 or www.marionhistory.com. Fred, great as always.
Until next time.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to my new fitting.
Me too.
And I don't read very much, but I am looking forward to reading this book when it shows up.
Well, the presidents are fascinating, and the first ladies are fascinating to study.
Yeah, they
both
certainly
their personal lives and their public lives.
All right, well, we're out of here. Fred, thanks a lot for coming in. We'll talk to you next month, and stay tuned. We're going to have a swap shop here in about 15 minutes, and I'll be back for another 45. All right.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM LP Marion, Ohio.